got one remaining case in the docket this morning at 11 o'clock, and it's my understanding the attorneys have checked in and are ready to proceed. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell. To my left is Justice Dabney Basil, and I'm Bonnie Sutterth. I'm the Chief Justice of the Court. We thank you for being here today, but before we begin the argument, I'll have the clerk call the case.
The court will now call Kelsey versus 37 Building Products. May it please the court, Mr. Nathan Norris to argue for the appellant, Mr. Matt Staten to argue for the appellee.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Nate Kennard representing Telsmith, Inc., the appellant in this case. This case is about a manufacturer of rock crushers, Telsmith, and the end user of two of those rock crushers, 37 Building Products. They did not have a contract between them, but 37 Building Products, on several occasions, called a Telsmith representative and asked for service on those crushers, which Telsmith performed.
Who did they act? Did they contact Telsmith directly, and is that in the record, or did they contact McCourt, and then McCourt contact Telsmith?
The record supports that both occurred. There are documents in the record reflecting that McCourt, the intermediary party, the dealer, performed certain service, but Marcus Martinez is a product service representative from Telsmith. His affidavit is contained in the, it's a declaration. And his declaration states that he was contacted on five separate occasions directly by directly by 37BP, after which he went to 37BP's site and performed service on those five occasions. Additionally,
were those contacts that initiated, could be described as initiating a claim, or were those contacts that had already occurred through McCourt, but there was some type of clarification with regard to what had already been initiated by McCourt?
The record does not present enough facts to address that question directly, but his declaration states that he was called five separate times directly by 37BP, and that is what his declaration states. Additionally, in 37BP's petition, they stated that on occasion, Telsmith also provided service. The citation of that paragraph is in our brief, our reply brief, I believe. I don't recall the exact page, but that is something which 37BP claimed in their original petition and thus is a binding admission, a judicial admission in this case. Additionally, some of the documents which 37BP relied upon in their responsive brief saying, look, these are warranty claims by McCourt. Well, those also say in several places, as described in our reply brief, that Telsmith was also on site. The statements made in a declaration which doesn't show any indicia of a lack of credibility, and especially if they could easily have been controverted by the other party, those statements in that declaration must be taken as true under the binding authority from the Texas Supreme Court. And that's what Mr. Martinez's declaration establishes in this case. He was in one paragraph, I believe it's on the second page of his declaration, he says, I was called by McCourt, the dealer, and I went to provide service. Second, the next paragraph, he says, on five occasions subsequently, I was contacted by 37BP.
Does he indicate whether that was on the same type of service complaint, and he's just going back and doing the same thing on the, okay, or are they on individual complaints with regard to need for service?
His declaration does not specify that detail.
Okay, is there any indication in his declaration that the warranty request form that specified, I believe in the manual, is used in any way, shape, or form by 37BP to invoke a claim under the warranty?
His declaration does not reflect that detail.
And there's not a form that's actually been filled out by anybody with 37 BP, that specific form to initiate a claim, is there?
That's correct.
Okay.
Ultimately, this case is about whether 37 BP's actions in calling Mr. Martinez and then getting warranty service, which otherwise would have cost about $35,000, whether that's enough of a basis to say that 37 BP has directly benefited from the warranty policy which Telsmith extends and is part of their agreement with their dealers. And this case is not directly controlled by any other authority that we have found. We have not found a case in which a buyer was orally informed that the manufacturer provided a warranty, or that the buyer purchased a million-dollar product, a rock crusher, brand new from a dealer, but the dealer said, this sale is as is, but we're passing through the manufacturer's warranty. Or a case in which the buyer signed a commissioning checklist at startup while present with a representative from the manufacturer, which says, or which refers to the warranties. Or a case in which the representative was speaking with a site supervisor, in this case Mr. Martinez, and said, you've got a one-year warranty from Telsmith. Under these circumstances, where you deal with sophisticated parties, commercial entities, not consumers, we're not talking about buying a bottle of water over the counter at CVS, we're talking about expensive, complicated goods between knowledgeable parties. Under these circumstances, and especially since the record supports that Mr. Martinez was called not one or two or three times to come provide warranty service, but on five separate occasions, after which 37 BP never paid anything, was never asked to pay anything, was never sent an invoice. In these circumstances, it's reasonable to conclude, in this kind of case, the court doesn't have to address a wide variety of circumstances, nor does it need to cast a broad net in describing the type of knowledge which 37 BP might be said to have had. But in this kind of case, a buyer which has gotten $35,000 worth of service should have be said to have knowledge of what it is that it was actually doing.
Let me ask you this, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's a very specific pleading here with regard to, I believe it's a Tier 3 engine for the impact crusher, okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
The allegation in the pleading is that there was a specific representation made by Telsmith in a meeting with McCourt and with 37 BP that this particular crusher was going to have a Tier 3 engine. Okay?
Yes,
and
sir.
The allegation is that in the event, upon the purchase, it didn't have a Tier 3 engine. Okay? So it's a component. It's represented to have that component. It doesn't have that component. Okay? It's not really a repair issue, but if the warranty kicked in, one would think that if it applied and if it kicked in, one would think that you would be seeing some indication that the Tier 3 engine had been replaced. Is there anything in the record that indicates, for example, with regard to Mr. Martinez, when he was contacted by 37 BP, that it dealt specifically with the lack of a Tier 3 engine and that there was a claim under the warranty, or even if they don't even mention the warranty, that, hey, you need to come put a Tier 3 engine in this particular crusher?
I'm not aware of anything in the record which addresses a particular claim or issue specifically, at least in the facts. The petition mentions the engine, but at least in the facts that are before the trial court, issues with that engine, Your Honor.
Okay. The reason I ask about that is because they make the argument that the limitation on the warranty doesn't necessarily exclude other express warranties that are actually made before entering into the agreement. So if Telsmith makes the representation that a Tier 3 engine is going to be a component of the impact crusher, and objectively no Tier 3 engine is a component of the impact crusher, why is that excluded? Yes, even assuming that the warranties all apply, et cetera, and they agreed to it, why is that particular one excluded under the misrepresentation argument that's made and the breach of express warranty that's made, which would be in addition to the actual warranty that's part of the dealer agreement?
I think the first answer, Your Honor, is main engine components, decision from Justice Willett on the Texas Supreme Court, says quite clearly, a subsequent purchaser can't get a better warranty than the initial purchaser got. In this case,
in this particular instance, is there not evidence that the warranty is actually made to 37 BP with regard to the purchase?
It was an allegation in the petition. The evidence before the court on page 49 of the record, page 44 of the appendix, actually says that what was included in the sale was a Tier 4 diesel engine. I think if, and this goes to the second theory of direct benefits estoppel that we've raised, that 37 BP, as part of its lawsuit against Telsmith, is seeking the benefits of the agreement necessarily, and the premise being that 37 BP can't get a better warranty than McCourt got. I think that's the context. This is not in relation to the first issue about getting the warranty service. And, Your Honor, I think the response is that when faced with, say, an oral warranty before, maybe about Tier 4 versus a Tier 3 engine, followed by a document which says, well, here's actually what you're going to get. And that document says it's actually going to be a Tier 4 engine. And that's made by a remote manufacturer. That if, say, McCourt made a different statement to 37 BP, I don't know how it is that Telsmith should be on the hook for something different than what was actually in the written specifications for the machine. Does that answer your question?
So you're saying by accepting the machine when it was delivered, okay, with specifications that indicated it's a Tier 4 diesel engine, as opposed to the pre-purchase alleged representation for warranty that it would be a Tier 3 engine, okay, that's kind of almost a merger type of argument that, well, you've accepted this, therefore you don't have any complaint about the original representation, if in fact it occurred.
Along those lines, Your Honor, I think there's a lot of problems here that arise from the fact on this issue between 37 BP being a remote buyer, right? Telsmith didn't sell this product directly to 37 BP. It sold it to McCourt. And so if McCourt was looking for a Tier 3 engine, they actually got a Tier 4 engine, but they had been looking at this specification on page 49 of the record, which actually says Tier 4, I think that the written disclaimer would control in that case, but it would depend on the factual circumstances, to be honest, on that issue. There's a larger problem when you've got a remote buyer that they may be asked McCourt for something, and then McCourt may be asked Telsmith for something else, maybe not the same thing. It's a difficult question about what it is that Telsmith should be on the hook for if what shows up is a Tier 4 instead of a Tier 3 engine. On the issue,
let me ask you this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's do it on a more common situation. Let's say you want to buy a GM car of some kind. You go to the dealer to buy it. It's a GM dealer, but that day you go, someone from GM actually is there and is helping discuss with you what is actually going to be sold to you through the dealership. So your actual transactions with the dealer, but in reaching that transaction, you're having representations made by GM in terms of the negotiations up front. So you're correct that the actual purchase is between the dealer and the purchaser, but the actual interaction in terms of negotiations for the purchase involved the actual manufacturer. And that seems to be, to a certain extent, at least what the allegations are in terms of the actual purchase involving Telsmith in the purchase, even though it wasn't a direct purchase from Telsmith. Telsmith was providing some type of assistance or some type of representation with regard to the actual purchase that was contemplated with McCord.
That may be the case, Your Honor, and again, this raises really difficult questions. What sort of remedies might be available to the buyer in that circumstance that might be available if they were, you know, if they had had a direct relationship with the manufacturer? That might be different if they don't have a direct relationship. Say if GM sells the vehicle to the dealer who sells the vehicle to the buyer in that case. Is only the dealer on the hook for the engine not being what the manufacturer said? If it's different from what the manufacturer said, you know, to what extent can the buyer, you know, revoke acceptance? These are difficult and complicated questions that have not been directly briefed by the parties in this case. And I see that my time has expired. And with that, I will return during my rebuttal.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
Would you add 1 minute to the appellee's time, please?
May it please the court. I want to address one thing Justice Bodwell was asking and the response from counsel, and it's this. You've latched onto the oral representations that occurred before the equipment was delivered. And in fact, the agreement that he points you to and makes that merger argument didn't come into existence until several months later. So Your Honor is absolutely right when he says these oral representations were what formed the basis of the claims, and they can't run from that by pointing to a document that we were non-signatory to several months later that we never saw, and then try to recast our pleadings for us and say, well, you're making an express warranty claim under an agreement that you never saw, when that's not at all what we said in our pleadings. And let me add something else, because counsel was very clear that these are sophisticated parties. Why didn't they ask us to sign an arbitration agreement if that's what they wanted us to do? Why did they have to resort to this tactic of a rarely used circumstance in legal theory to make an end run on something? If we're the true sophisticated parties that they're representing us to be, let's put in front of us a warranty contract that contains an arbitration clause, and let's agree to those terms. But we didn't agree to those terms. In fact, we rejected, according to them, they sent it to us and it had a signature page which was never signed.
Well, you agreed to term that included a warranty pass-through.
If applicable.
If applicable, but the way you argue it, it would never be applicable because the non-assignability.
Correct, Your Honor.
So what's the point of the language of passing through if applicable if, in fact, it's never assignable?
I would agree with the conclusion that the non-assignability would have to control, because it's clear language that says this doesn't go beyond the scope of the two parties. And when I believe our agreement was with McCourt that said the pass-through, if applicable, separate agreement, sales contract, different from the non-assignability of McCourt's contract with Telsmith. So we're talking about two different agreements there.
Okay, so let's talk about the contract with McCourt. What warranties being discussed as being passed through?
Well, we wouldn't know because we didn't have any knowledge of the terms of that agreement. We weren't a party to it. Obviously, they've admitted that.
A term of your agreement with McCourt.
A term of our agreement with McCourt was that any warranties, if applicable, would pass through. We didn't have any warranties with Telsmith. They had a limited warranty policy between the two of them that was not assignable to any third party. So it ends there. It can't pass through. But the issue is whether we sought the direct benefit of a contract that we never saw. That's the legal test here today for direct benefits estoppel, is whether we had knowledge of and deliberately invoked and obtained the benefits of this policy. And there's no evidence that we knew of the terms of the dealer agreement, none whatsoever. And specifically, There's no evidence that we knew about an arbitration clause contained therein, in the dealer agreement, because they can't show you that we ever saw it. It was between the two of them, and we never even knew it was out there until this litigation started. And that's why they pled we don't have privity of contract with them, and that's why we pled certain oral representations that induced us and negligent misrepresentations. That's how the whole nature of this case gets framed up. I would also like to back up and point out one thing. They haven't proven that there's a valid enforceable arbitration agreement in the first place. And the trial court latched onto this because, of course, they've admitted to you, as they must, that the contract they're relying on is not signed. And so it falls outside the statute of frauds. And what they've said to you for the first time on appeal, I hope you'll look at their motion to compel arbitration, because it doesn't make this argument. They say, we have an enforceable contract. It's been, quote, executed. That's what they told the trial judge. When we responded, we pointed out, hold on a minute, you've just slapped together some documents that have multiple dates on them, but don't have a signature. So they said, aha, at the Court of Appeals, we'll change that argument. We'll say that the course of conduct of the parties, McCourt and Telsmith, not us, McCourt and Telsmith, dictates that there must be an enforceable agreement.
Did they not raise the UCC non-signature argument at the trial court?
They did not make the argument. In all candor, Your Honor, there's a footnote where they say there's an enforceable agreement, and that footnote cites one case, and I believe it cites section 2.201 of the UCC, which is statute of frauds. They make no argument like they've made in the briefs in this court. They don't point to letterhead. They don't point to, the conduct of the parties. Obviously, they accepted delivery. But the key here is, instead of an express contract with an arbitration clause that they're trying to hoist upon us, they say implied contract by conduct. Well, what is that, Your Honor? That's a fact issue. And the judge looked at all the facts in equity and said, I see an unsigned agreement. I see parties' conduct that I can't tell what McCourt did or didn't do as to a warranty or as to an arbitration agreement, because they didn't put forth anything attached to their motion to compel to show what McCourt accepted or didn't accept as to the new terms of this implied contract. So the judge said, well, I don't even have an enforceable arbitration agreement, and that's part of the reason for the denial. Now, when we turn to an issue that they also want to run away from, it's the Noble case from the Fifth Circuit, which has been cited by the Texas Supreme Court. And what the Texas Supreme Court has said is, we're going to follow federal precedent, and the federal courts have said we must have express knowledge of the material terms of the agreement you're trying to enforce against us as a non-signatory. They can't meet that burden. They've almost conceded as much by the way they briefed it in their reply by saying, well, that's a Fifth Circuit case. That's not really binding here today. But I think if you look at Emory Weekly and you look at the litany of Fifth Circuit cases, we cited, I believe, two in a federal case. There's several. We looked again, and the Fifth Circuit is very clear, and it makes perfect sense why. You can't bind us to arbitration in Wisconsin on a warranty policy that we didn't know the terms of. Now, the warranty request form is another issue that Your Honor seized upon, and I'd like to point out that that conclusively shows there was only one party seeking warranty work here. It was the party submitting those warranty request forms, because the limited warranty or the warranty policy that's in the dealer agreement specifically says that they won't do any warranty work unless you do things their way. McCourt submitted the warranty requests. We had nothing to do with that. That's the type of evidence that's conclusive on an issue like this, that we were not seeking to invoke the terms of that warranty policy.
But McCourt would not be submitting that form without a complaint from you.
No question we complained that the two pieces of equipment weren't working. We spent $2 million on them. And service work was certainly requested. But there's a difference between asking somebody to fix a problem that they're responsible for and invoking the terms of an express warranty in a different agreement that we're not a party to.
Is there anything in the agreement that you had with McCourt that dealt with? The only thing I remember being pointed to is the pass-through language.
That's all I remember as well, Your Honor.
There's nothing in that agreement that sets forth any actual warranty language about how, if in fact the product that is being sold does not conform or is defective in some way, shape, or form. There's no specific language in the agreement you've got with McCourt with regard to warranties.
In all candor, I don't want to misrepresent my answer. That is what I believe the record to show as well, but I can certainly double check. I don't want to misrepresent something, but that's my recollection.
Okay.
But there's nothing else other than the provision you and I have already discussed. that would show how this works. And even if there was, that's our agreement with McCourt. McCourt hasn't tried to send us to arbitration under any agreement. Not that agreement, not the other agreement. I mean, we're talking about a separate contract altogether that they're trying to enforce against us. And I think this court understands, based on the case law, that that's a limited circumstance. It only occurs when injustice is going to prevail over equity.
Well, your agreement with McCourt has an as-is provision in it.
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
Okay. And the only other that I remember seeing anywhere in the briefs is the warranties only mentioned in the terms of if applicable passing through. Okay. So there's apparently just lack of curiosity on y'all's part with regard to how you're going to get something fixed if it doesn't work the way it's supposed to.
The record, I believe the record is silent on our lack of curiosity or not. We certainly made service calls initially to McCourt, which is part of the timeline I think Your Honor understands, and then when McCourt couldn't solve the problems, that's when they looped Mr. Martinez in.
Did you ever raise anywhere with regard to McCourt the Tier 3 engine on the impact crusher?
I believe that was one of the complaints that was made.
Okay.
I know it's part of our allegations.
Do you know whether or not that was one of the contacts that was made directly with regard to Martinez?
I do not, standing here, know whether that was the answer to that question, Your Honor. I apologize.
Okay. The reason I'm asking is you appear to be making an argument that the only initiation of any service obligation, whether that could be characterized as a warranty obligation, okay, was communication with McCourt with regard to this isn't working the way it's supposed to. Yet the Martinez declaration indicates that there was direct contact with Telsmith under similar circumstances, which is what they're invoking with regard to estoppel. Okay, so how are we to deal with the direct contact? Obviously, they're saying, "Look, you're treating it as a warranty situation because you're calling with the expectation, okay, that a product that's been purchased." And you're contacting the manufacturer to get a specific obligatory response with regard to fixing what has been complained about.
I think, first of all, it's important to understand that the record shows we were contacting McCourt, and then when they couldn't fix the problem, Martinez stepped in, and our conversations with Martinez were scheduling calls. Like, we need to get you out here. That there's nothing more going on there. And if you look at his affidavit, which they've trumpeted heavily, It never mentions the dealer agreement. It never mentions specific warranty provisions. In fact, they want you to believe that it's some unrebuttable testimony, but it was dated October 2017, according to Mr. Martinez, when he came out for the first time and disclosed this warranty.
Is there anything in the record, having had warranty work done at my house kind of thing, usually when somebody comes out and fixes it, they want you to sign off and say, yeah, something got done. Is there any type of anything in the record that indicated that 37BP was acknowledging anything that could be characterized as warranty work?
I don't believe so. There is certainly documents in the record that show a warranty request made by McCourt. There's certainly some emails, I believe, in the record that validate that somebody came out and tried to fix the problem, which, by the way, the problems were never fixed, but that's...
Well, let me give you an example, okay?
I don't believe there's an acknowledgement, Your Honor.
But if there was, let's say Mr. Martinez comes out, okay, based upon scheduling, okay, and he purports to fix whatever the complaint is addressed to, and then in order to be able to show his employer, Telsmith, that he actually responded the way he was supposed to, he says, "Here's your invoice," and the invoice mentions this is warranty work of some kind, okay? Would that not be some type of evidence that you understood you're getting warranty work done from the manufacturer, which might then put you on notice that there's a warranty involved that could be enforceable from an estoppel-type standpoint?
I think that when you break down that question, it certainly could be some evidence that somebody thought they were getting warranty work, but what dictates the terms of that warranty? Here, it's a contract that we had never seen. So Martinez said he came and told us, you have a warranty for a year. Okay. Does that mean we're somehow stopped because of a contract he has floating out, his employer has floating out here with a dealer that we don't know anything about? Because again, they haven't shown, you got to put yourself in the direct benefits estoppel box. And what the Supreme Court has said and what the Fifth Circuit has said, we have to know the terms of the agreement. Even if somebody came out and performed work, even if somebody told us there's a warranty, that's wonderful. To bind us to a contract we're a non-signatory on, including arbitration clauses that send us to Wisconsin, there has to be more. And the Supreme Court and the Fifth Circuit has said, you must show more. So that's a long-winded way of saying those facts can be in existence and it wouldn't mean the estoppel doctrine applies as a matter of law. And that's what they have to show here. Because it's an equitable doctrine, the court weighed all the equities it had in front of it, it weighed all the fact issues, and it found, I either think there's no arbitration clause that's valid here at all, or they haven't shown that these parties knew about the terms of the contract, or there was no direct benefit at all as to express warranty work. Any of those three, and the judge has to be affirmed. If the panel doesn't have any further questions, I'll yield the limited remainder of my time. Thank you, Your Honors.
First thing, Your Honor, no case says that an absolute minimum in order to knowingly benefit from a contract, you have to know the specific terms. No case says that.
What do you have to know?
I think you have to know enough to know what it is that you're getting. And I think that that needs to be something that's flexible based on the particular circumstances presented in a particular case. Now, there's some helpful guidance. Lawyer versus Lawyer, a case we cited in our brief from the Houston Court of Appeals. At issue in that case was a shareholder agreement. And the plaintiff in that case, she claimed, I've never seen the choice of forum clause in this agreement, so it's inequitable to enforce it against me, but the court said that didn't matter. It was sufficient that she realized the benefits of a sale of those goods to a tune of $30 million. Thus, she directly benefited from that agreement. But the specific question was raised that she hadn't seen
it. Was she aware of the agreement itself? And was claiming that she simply had not read that particular term of the agreement.
As to pre-litigation, the court says nothing about whether she had seen it or knew anything about it. Now, by the time of litigation, she was suing on the basis of it. Those are two different bases for the conclusion, but the court did not discuss that question at all, but it did say she didn't, even if she didn't know about the choice of forum clause. I think that's relevant here. Should you have to read every term of a contract in order to knowingly exploit it? Even the Fifth Circuit cases, which opposing counsel has raised, don't actually say that the parties, you know, actually read the agreement. All they say is that these parties had it. That's it. Thus, presumably, they're imputed to know something about it. But none of those cases say that it's actually...
This record shows that 37 BP falls within the standard you just established, that they knew that the dealer agreement existed.
I think that they knew that there was a warranty. They knew that when Telsmith's technician arrived and he said, you have a one-year warranty from Telsmith. When they signed their agreement with the dealer, said, we're not giving you any warranties, but we're passing through what the manufacturer had. And then five service calls, no invoices, no questions, just $35,000 out of Telsmith's pocket. And I'm not saying that this is a slam dunk case. It's not. This falls in between the case like Noble Drilling, Fifth Circuit, where the court said there's no evidence that this plaintiff had any knowledge of this agreement. That's not this case. Pass through manufacturer's warranty, oral statement, you've got a warranty from Telsmith, from the technician, and then multiple instances of after being called by Telsmith, free warranty service. I would note, page 74 of the record, I performed at least five service visits to 37 BP after 37 BP called me directly and requested the service. It's not complicated. It's simple. It's not detailed. It's simple. And I would emphasize, there are cases in which saying that possessing the contract is sufficient to show they had knowledge of the agreement, and there are cases saying, if you know nothing, that's not enough. We're somewhere in the middle. And I would also emphasize that there is no case saying that in this middle ground, estoppel is inequitable. 37BP has showed no case resembling this in-between level of knowledge saying that that's not enough. Well, we have commercial entities, sophisticated entities that know what they're doing. You have this, you know, this sequence of events. That should be enough to show that 37BP knew what it was getting and was getting that that warranty service. A few other quick notes. Why didn't Telsmith force 37BP to sign an agreement first? That certainly would have been ideal. But if that were a requirement, then direct benefits estoppel wouldn't exist. We'd be traveling under a contract theory, and certainly we'd rather do that. But now that they've gotten their cake of $35,000, they should have to eat the other aspects too. A few other notes. Opposing counsel discussed at length what the trial court did and didn't think. But the trial court actually said nothing about the merits of the issue other than he denied the motion. We'd love to know what his thoughts were, but that's simply not in the record, and it's not reflected in his order or in the trial, or in the transcript from the hearing.
What is your response to counsel's argument that you did not raise the UCC non-signature ground in the trial court?
That's simply incorrect. In our initial motion, to be frank, we didn't think that this was going to be a contested issue. It's very common in between sophisticated parties to send documents back and forth and ship the goods. So in our initial motion, we didn't address the question at length because we've got a purchase order from the buyer, and then we've got a subsequent confirmation from the seller, including additional terms, and then we've got the good actually being shipped, and then we've got the good being resold to another party and actually put in use. The case we cited in our brief addressed that in those circumstances, you've got an acceptance. If the good's been resold, the good has been accepted. And if the good's been accepted, the UCC adopts a very lax policy about under what circumstances we'll find an agreement. And it will strain, in fact, to find an agreement wherever possible. Under these circumstances, that should be found to be the case. I would note that our briefing below does argue that we had an agreement in the opening and reply brief, a little more in the reply brief. But
your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument. It's been very helpful to us. Your case has now been submitted. You're free to go.